You're listening to This Month in HIV, the body's monthly podcast discussion about the latest, most important developments in HIV. For more information on this podcast, including a full transcript, visit us on the web at www.thebody.com/HIVmonth.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of The Body, and I'd like to welcome you to April's This Month in HIV. This month, we focus on HIV for people with some treatment experience and perhaps some HIV drug resistance. What does it mean when your HIV develops resistance to many HIV medications? If you have drug resistance, what are your options? In the bad old days, if your HIV developed drug resistance, it was often a challenge for physicians to cobble together a powerful second regimen. Many doctors were completely stumped if they had to figure out a third or a fourth regimen. HIV doctors even created a brutal term to describe people with multi-drug resistance, salvage patients. As more and more people with HIV develop drug resistance, salvage therapy, or as we prefer calling it, rescue therapy, became one of the hottest topics in HIV treatment. But the times are changing. If you are someone whose HIV has developed resistance to lots of HIV drugs, there is no reason to give up hope. In fact, the word salvage may not even be a valid word to use anymore, if it ever was. We now have more HIV medications than ever before that can help people who have multidrug resistance. And there are many more drugs in development. The key is making sure that both you and your doctor have the knowledge you need to come up with a treatment regimen that works. To help us learn more about dealing with multidrug resistance, I contacted Dr. Eric Darr, the chief of HIV medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles and a professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine. He has been an active HIV physician and researcher since the 1980s and is an authority on patients with multidrug resistance. He also answers questions regarding HIV treatment resistance at thebody.com.
Dr. Darr, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what you do.
Sure. So I'm a clinician scientist. I work at Harbor UCLA Medical Center, where we take care of about 800 to 900 HIV-infected individuals in our clinic. We have largely a Ryan White-funded program and take care of a very diverse patient population who are dealing with many of the complexities of both life and HIV disease. And we have a very active research program, primarily clinical research, as well as research to better define how HIV actually causes disease. And we study people looking at novel ways to treat or optimize therapy, as well as to further understand what's going on with the interaction between the person and the virus.
Mm-hmm. So how has the treatment of people who are treatment experienced, how has that changed over the years? Are we in a new era now?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about it. Things have evolved over the last 5 years or so and continue to evolve, particularly with the emergence of new drugs and new classes. We've for a long time realized that when people don't do well on their initial regimen, that they can develop drug-resistant virus. And in the early era of combination antiretroviral therapy, often that first regimen was the best shot at full suppression, and after that it became very difficult. And with new drugs, with new characteristics, we've had better success in people who have failed perhaps their first or even second regimen with viral rebound. I think what we're finding now is that even for people who are on their third, fourth, or fifth regimen, we have a reasonable chance of achieving our goal, which is now evolved to being complete viral suppression, even in these people who are more treatment experienced with multi-drug resistant virus.
Could we define what is somebody's treatment experience? If they have a resistance test and they're resistant to almost everything, does that mean that they're, even if they only took one or two regimens, does that mean that they're suddenly in that category of treatment experience?
Yeah, really, it's. I think when we think, at least when I talk about somebody being treatment resistant or treatment experienced, I'm thinking of the person who, for any one of a variety of reasons, has had difficulties with their first early regimens, whether that's because they've experienced viral rebound with drug-resistant virus or because they've not tolerated existing agents. I think of them as treatment experienced. And then from the perspective of resistance, we can then further characterize them as having limited treatment options, being highly drug-resistant, or perhaps those who have a lot of options, because they don't have a lot of resistance, but maybe have had some difficulties with their earlier regimens because of tolerability or their ability to take the medications consistently. So we really, you know, hate to put everybody in the same group, and we're thinking about a range of individuals who have been on treatment in the past, are looking at subsequent regimens, some of whom have many options as far as available treatments, and others who are more limited.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of dealing with a resistance test that shows that someone is resistant to everything, what are the first things that you do?
Sure. So one of the more complicated situations are those people who have a lot of drug resistance. And the current guidelines have recommended now for the last year or so that our goal still be to see if we can come up with a new regimen that would allow them to have complete viral suppression or get their viral loads to levels that are undetectable. And the reason we do that is partly because obviously we think they'll do better, but even more importantly, it's because we believe if we can do that, we can prevent their virus from becoming resistant to the new drugs as well. And that's why it's our goal. And I'll preface this by saying that while that is our goal, it's not always achievable in everybody. And it's not to suggest that you can't achieve that goal right now, all is lost, because that's clearly not the case. It just means that we need to redefine the goals and be strategic. So let me sort of tell you sort of how we work through a patient like this, who comes to us, who's perhaps been on therapy in the past, and has experienced viral rebound on that treatment. And the first thing we'll do is we'll try to get a sense as to sort of which group they fall within. Are they the kind of person who is treatment experienced with minimal drug-resistant virus or a lot of drug resistance? And, you know, you proposed the patient who has the more extensive resistance pattern, but it can really be everything in between. And we'll look at their drug resistance, usually with a drug resistance test, whether it be a genotype or a phenotype, and we can talk more about that if you'd like. But one of these tests that can be performed in the clinic that will give us a sense as to which drugs their virus may still be susceptible to. In addition, and this is extremely important, is we don't just look at the results from the test right now. We'll also want to go back and look through the patient's medical record and perhaps look at previous drug resistance tests to further define what kinds of resistant virus they'd selected for in the past. And we'll also look at their treatment history. Sometimes that will give us clues as to which drugs may or may not be active.
So then it's really important that patients keep medical records, a copy of it, because sometimes I know that's if you move around, that's hard to get, and that's really important information.
Extremely important, particularly in the current era where people do move around a lot or their insurance changes and forces them to seek out medical care in another environment. So as proactive as the patient can be in making sure that they have access to all their medical records, the better, to assist their new provider in coming up with the best regimen.
And could you define rebound?
Yeah, so viral rebound, there's really what we're talking about in the most obvious case is somebody whose viral load went to undetectable or below the limits of detection with the current assays. And then while they're taking treatment, suddenly it's noted that their virus rebounds or comes back up to detectable levels. And we realize that sometimes that can happen at low levels and it's meaningless and you simply repeat the results and it's back down to undetectable, in which case there's no problem. But in the people where it's persistently detectable, we think they've had viral rebound, and that can occur for a variety of reasons. The obvious one and the one we're focusing on is the person's actually developed resistance to their drugs. But there are other times where that may not be true. It may be because they're simply not taking their medications consistently.
So is resistance always a result of not taking your meds?
No, resistance can occur for a lot of reasons. One of the big risk factors for it occurring is not taking the medications consistently. But it can also occur if the regimen that's selected is not sufficiently potent or doesn't have enough active drugs within the regimen to get the virus down to undetectable. And if you don't achieve that goal, which, you know, again, that is our optimal goal, then it's inevitable that some resistance or increasing resistance will occur.
So a patient should be proactive if their doctor isn't, if they were undetectable and then they come back with a viral test that is detectable, nothing is done. How quickly should something be done? And what should be done? Is it at that point a resistance test should be taken?
I think the first step is to make sure the person's, you know, taking the medications consistently. And this requires a very open dialogue between the patient and the provider. because it's something we really want our patients to feel comfortable sharing with us any problems they're having with taking their medications. You know, this is a group effort. This isn't something that needs to be left to the patient alone. And if they're having difficulties, whether it's because the medications make them sick or the way the medications are given is at a bad time of the day for them around their work or schedule or other factors, or if the person is using drugs or depressed or, you know, binge drinking on the weekends and missing their doses, the best thing that the patient can do is share that with their provider so that we can work together to figure out what to do next to try to avoid the development of resistance. So that's the first step. And then the next step is to make sure that that rebound in virus is consistent. So we'll generally repeat the test. And I don't think there's any urgency, meaning days or minutes, but over the next week or month, these things need to be sorted out so a decision can be made as to whether to do a drug resistance test and then how or if to modify therapy based upon those results.
So the timeline then is I get back, let's say, a viral load test that is detectable, and with then I am immediately given another test, or they do you wait a week or so?
I don't think there's hard and fast rules. I wouldn't wait 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But I think over the next week or several weeks or a month, depending on, you know, convenience for the patient, I don't think a lot's going to change over that period of time. But you don't want it to go on much longer than, you know, 3 to 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So you get another viral test, and if that test shows that you're still detectable, then is that the point when a resistance test is given?
Yeah, I think that would be the right time. There are some caveats, and people whose viral loads are low, for example, less than maybe 1,000, there can be difficulties in doing drug resistance testing. So sometimes they need to be followed more closely, or occasionally decisions need to be made on changing therapy without resistance testing. That requires a more detailed discussion.
Mm-hmm. So this is the most complicated part of HIV treatment.
Oh, without a doubt, because then even after you get the results and you've collected all the information, you know, then your goal is to try to get a sense as to what options are available for the patient. You know, are they willing to commit to taking a new regimen? How many active drugs are available? And I think what we've learned is that the more active drugs, meaning drugs in which the virus is susceptible that are included in the regimen, the better the chance of getting done detectable. And sometimes that's easy. If the person doesn't have a lot of resistance, it's easy to identify 3 active drugs. In other cases, it's more difficult, and it really does require an expert provider to be able to interpret the tests as well as use their own experience to try to give the patient an idea as to whether they think at this moment right now there is a regimen available to them for which they think there's a good chance undetectable virus can be achieved. And also discuss, you know, what are the risks of going down this path, both with regards to new toxicities associated with those drugs, as well as if things don't go right and the viral load doesn't go to undetectable, what other options might be lost as far as new drugs for which resistance will develop that might otherwise be important for future regimens. And I think right now we need to be cognizant of that more than ever because there are a lot of new options that are going to be available to people over the next 6 months. So we don't want to waste drugs now. We want to use them very strategically to make sure that we have as many options available to our patients in the future as these new drugs emerge onto the scene.
You didn't discuss CD4 count. So how does that relate to in terms of changing regimens? If your CD4 count is in the 200s and it sort of stays there, you know, more or less, goes up maybe 20, just very, very little, but you are undetectable, does that mean that something should be done, that regimen should be changed?
That's a great question because really when we think about treatment failure, we can think about it in sort of 3 different ways. The one we focus on is virologic failure, the viral rebound and drug resistance. And I think that's probably the most important one for most patients because in general, we believe that if you can keep viral loads undetectable, regardless of what's going on with CD4 counts, for the most part, people are going to stay healthy. But there are other ways in which people fail. There are people who are failing therapy, not just because their virus is rebounded, but also their CD4s are going down, or they're getting sick with AIDS-related complications. So I think we focus on the virus initially, with our goal being to try to get it to undetectable, and if we achieve that goal, we worry less about CD4s, and sometimes they'll go up a lot, sometimes they won't. But again, in general, we feel comforted by the fact that most of our patients won't get sick with undetectable viral loads, even if their CD4 stay around 200.
But there was a study at the International CROI conference, and I think it was about cancer and HIV. And I think the take-home to that was that people should not have suppressed immune systems for a long period of time because bad things happen. I don't know what you felt. I mean, I thought it was a scary study. And it did sort of, I thought the take-home was it warned against staying in the 200s if you have HIV and doing something about it, being more proactive, I guess. What did you think?
I think the studies, there are actually several studies now that have sort of come on the scenes that suggest that in addition to AIDS-related complications with traditional infections, that there may be some non-AIDS-related issues that can emerge in people with lower T cells, everything from liver disease to even non-AIDS cancers. And I think that we should use that perhaps to make the case for when we start therapy. I don't think it helps us too much in what to do in the person who has undetectable levels of virus but has had only modest increases in CD4s, perhaps to 200. That setting, because most of those studies really haven't addressed that population. They're looking at all comers based on CD4 counts, where the majority of the ones with low CD4 counts are unlikely to have undetectable levels of virus. So, and I think this is an important point because it does happen, and patients are concerned about it when they're doing great virologically, but their CD4s haven't gone up as much as they like. And I think in general, we don't have a lot of good ideas or data to tell us what to do in the person with undetectable viral loads whose T cells are sort of stalling at around 200. And there's little reason to believe that modifying therapy, and for the most part, and certainly discussions need to occur between the provider and the patient, but for the most part, there's little data to suggest that modifying therapy will have a dramatic impact, or that there's some other immunologic intervention that can be recommended. So I've generally, and I think most of my colleagues, have simply tried to reassure our patients that as long as their viral load is undetectable, we would love their T cells to go higher, but the most important thing is to continue to take their medications consistently, and we'll focus on the viral load. And our experience is that the majority of these people are not going to get sick as long as we keep their virus in check.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess let's go back to the resistant patient. So can you explain why would it still make sense to be taking some medications even if you're resistant to them?
Sure. So it turns out that resistance testing, like everything else in life, is not perfect. And we realize that it's not an all or nothing thing for many drugs. And that for a lot of the drugs, you have people who have no resistance at all. And you have people where their virus is 100% resistant, for which they derive no additional benefit from the drugs. And then there's a lot of people who are in between. And we take advantage of that. And people who have enough drug-resistant virus that we don't have lots of great new drugs to give them, we realize from a variety of different studies that leaving them on some therapy is better than none. Now, these are people who we may not be able to get to undetectable, in which case our goals change a little bit. And in this situation, our goal, because they have so much drug-resistant virus or because they don't tolerate the available drugs that they need, our goal is to keep them clinically and immunologically stable. So we can't get their viral load to undetectable, but we don't want them to get sick. And we know from experience that leaving these people on some regimen, some drugs, and picking which of those drugs are most important is really a more of an art than a science, that by doing that, we can keep their T cells stable, keep them from getting ill while we're waiting for new drugs to become available, with the idea that eventually we're going to be able to come up with that regimen that will suppress the virus to undetectable levels. And I think that the data is really strong for leaving people on some drugs in that setting, where you may not be able to get them undetectable now, but you want to keep them healthy while you're waiting.
And so I know there's a test called a replication capacity test. Is that one that is used in this kind of situation?
Yeah, the replication capacity test is it's part of one of the companies that makes a drug resistance test, the phenotype test. They have that as an add-on. They simply give you this result, and it gives you a sense as to how well your virus grows in the test tube. And we believe that viruses that have a lot of drug resistance don't grow as well. And that maybe, and there's some evidence to support this, it's this inability of the virus to grow well in its mutated state that allows for these people to remain relatively stable despite having complete viral suppression on therapy. So,
despite having viral suppression or despite not having?
Despite not having viral suppression or only partial suppression. So right now, I think what we've learned is that measurement probably explains, at least in part, some of the benefit we're getting from leaving people on partially suppressive therapy. How we use it in clinical practice continues to be the challenge. So right now, it seems to explain what's going on more than allowing us to guide therapy.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, and tell me about access to the new medications. I know there are a couple of expanded access programs for some of the new medications, but I understand that universities and a number of other entities do not get involved with expanded access. Is your university able to get the new drugs through expanded access?
Yeah, so expanded access is a system that really evolved from the HIV epidemic, where it became clear to the agency, the Food and Drug Administration, that there were people in desperate need of new drugs, and that while we want these drugs to be thoroughly tested in clinical trials, that once they appear to be promising, we would like them to be available as soon as possible for the people who have desperate needs. And that's what really started many years ago.
Well, it was an activist thing. I think the activists sort of fought for it because it doesn't exist in other disease states.
Absolutely. So it was really a byproduct of the activist movement for HIV and AIDS. And it started, 15 years ago and continues today. And we now have three new drugs that have been developed and will have activity against otherwise drug-resistant virus. One is an NNRTI, so this is a drug related to Sestiva and Viremune, but it's active in people who have had resistance to those previous drugs. And then there are two drugs in new classes. One of them is a so-called integrase inhibitor, and the other is a CCR5 inhibitor. So these are drugs that work in a completely new way, unlike the previous nukes and non-nukes and protease inhibitors. And they're all available through expanded access programs. And you're right, not all centers, whether it's academic or otherwise, are involved in expanded access programs. A lot of it is based upon, I think, the individual site and what the perceived needs are. Unfortunately, there requires a considerable amount of work for sites to get these set up. Some centers, it takes so long to get approval that basically, the drug becomes approved and readily available before they can get the expanded access program set up. Other centers may not find a need for it because they have these drugs available through the clinical trials. We've generally not routinely done expanded access programs because we've participated in the clinical trials, and that's the mechanism we've used for getting these drugs available for our patients.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, if you need new drugs, talk to your providers about it. And if your provider's not doing it in their program, you can either through them or contact the companies directly, find out which providers in your community do have the expanded access program available.
Let's go back to the patient. The patient takes a resistance test and has a lot of resistance. So the resistance test does not show any of the new medications. So is one to just presume that one is that those agents would be active? But we don't know because it wasn't on the resistance test.
Right. So that's a challenge. It's particularly a challenge for new drugs in old classes. So, for example, when a new protease inhibitor comes along, initially, we really don't know whether the patient will respond. We know that if you look at a group of people who are protease resistant, that a proportion will respond. But we don't really know how to define which individuals within that group. And that's the case certainly with the new NNRTI, this etravirine, previously known as TMC-125. Not everybody who is otherwise resistant to the first generation non-nucleosides will be susceptible to this drug, and we don't really know yet how to predict that. Eventually, we'll have more information, but right now, it's a bit of guesswork. for the new drugs and novel classes, so for example, integrase inhibitor, I think it's safe to assume, based on what we know so far, that anybody who's never been on an integrase inhibitor will have a virus that's fully susceptible to that drug. So the absence of that on a resistance test probably isn't that important, because you can pretty much rely on susceptibility for now. Once people start taking these drugs, then it's a different story. The CCR5 inhibitors are a whole nother animal, in that while people who've never been on a CCR5 inhibitor are likely to have a virus that will be susceptible to it, the drug actually blocks CCR5, which is a receptor for the virus on the surface of the cell. That's how it works. It turns out, for reasons we don't completely understand, that during the course of disease, upwards of 50% of people will develop viruses that actually use another receptor called CXCR4. These CCR5 inhibitors won't block those viruses. So while it's not an issue of resistance, there are a subset of individuals who may not respond as well to CCR5 inhibitors as others. And there's an assay that's being developed and will be implemented along with these drugs to tell patients whether their virus uses CCR5 alone, in which case they should be a good candidate for the drug, versus whether it uses that other receptor as well, in which case they may not be as good a candidate for the drug.
Mm-hmm. So it is these new drugs that are changing what it means to be a treatment experience, or is it something else?
Oh, I think it's clearly the new drugs are making having a big impact, because for the highly treatment experienced patient who limited options, to suddenly say, you know, well, we've got some new protease inhibitors like tipranovir and darunavir, which were approved in the last year or so, that are going to be active for many of them, not all, but many. And now we have a new non-nucleoside for people who are resistant to the old ones, like this etravirine. And then on top of that, we also have new drugs and new classes for which most people will be susceptible, like integrase and CCR5. The idea of creating a regimen with two or three fully active drugs suddenly doesn't appear as daunting in the setting of highly treatment-experienced patients when you have all these new options that you may be able to combine. In addition, you can't forget about T20 or enfuvirtide, which is also another novel drug in a unique class for which patients should be their virus should be very susceptible if they've not been on it in the past.
So you've gotten questions, I'm sure, because you answer questions at the body of from people who say, you know, my sister's doctor says she's resistant to everything and she should just pack up her bags and get ready to die. What do you think, and what do you recommend when you see those kind of questions?
Yeah, almost never. You know, like I said, even partial suppressive therapy can keep people clinically stable. Even people who have very low T cells often will remain clinically stable for a long period of time, meaning having no symptoms of AIDS for months or even years. And we can't predict, and obviously if somebody has been ravaged by AIDS-related complications, there is a point where there's nothing left to do. But just because someone has a lot of drug resistance, you never give up. You know, we saw a lot of people who were in desperate straits back in 1995 who held on for protease inhibitors and who are now alive today with undetectable viruses and normal immune systems, and in all likelihood will never suffer the consequences of AIDS. I think we're at a point very similar to that now with these new drugs coming along, that for even those people who are highly treatment experienced, maybe even those who have low T cells but are otherwise relatively asymptomatic, that if we can just get them to hold on for another 6 to 12 months, we may have the tools we need in the clinic to offer them what we offered many people back in 95, 96, where we'll be able to put them on a new regimen, get their viral loads undetectable, get their immune system strong again, and perhaps they too will never suffer the consequences of AIDS. So I think there's reason for optimism right now.
Uh-huh. It's just hopefully the information will spread to throughout the country, because there are a lot of physicians, I think, that are not clear about that. They get a resistance test back. It looks like the patient's resistant to everything, and that's the end of that. They don't know, I think, about the new drugs in development or the expanded access programs or that they can be taking drugs and still do okay. I mean, I don't know if that's been, you know, because I know on our site we get a lot of notes from people whose doctors have given up on them.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, I don't want to suggest there are certainly people who are so sick already that there's limitations, but that's different than somebody who just has a lot of resistant virus. That's a completely different scenario, and I think there's very good reason to continue to be optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dar.
Thank you.
Now I'm pleased to welcome to This Month in HIV, Jeff Berry, Director of Publications and Editor of Positively Aware at Test Positive Aware Network, the oldest peer-led HIV service provider in Chicago. Jeff has been working in HIV/AIDS at Test Positive Aware Network in various positions since 1992. I thought he'd be interesting to talk to since he just finished being immersed in this issue, as the March-April issue of his publication is called Hope for Survival, Salvage Therapy Revisited. The issue focuses on how therapy for the treatment experienced has changed. On a more personal note, Jeff is very familiar with the subject since he is moderately treatment experienced himself. He has been HIV positive since 1989 and has taken an assortment of HIV medications. Welcome, Jeff, to This Month in HIV.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
Sure. You know, one of my first questions is about the terminology. There are so many terms for someone who is treatment experienced. What does it mean to you, a treatment experienced person?
Sure. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I think we did this issue, is because there is some confusion out there about the different terms, and you hear so many different terms. You hear salvage, you hear rescue, and you hear treatment experience, and you hear them used interchangeably. And so I thought it would be interesting, you know, to talk about some people's different experiences and salvage and rescue therapy. But treatment experience to me really just means that you've actually been on treatment. So
it doesn't mean you're very treatment experienced. It just means that you've had some experience.
Correct. And there are actually different levels of treatment experience. You know, we can get into that maybe a little bit. But so someone could be, you know, moderately treatment experienced. You know, they could be in an intermediate stage or advanced stage, or just as in HIV disease, there's different, you know, stages of and different levels of disease. There's also different levels of treatment experience.
But the ones that I guess when people say, "Oh, we need new drugs for the treatment experienced," doctors will say that, and I guess what they're meaning is people who have multi-drug resistance.
Right. So your probabilities for success with, you know, the different therapies that are currently available are less when you have multi-drug resistant virus. So if you're resistant to many drugs in one class, such as the non-nuke class, if you were Systeva and Viramune and fall in that category, if you are resistant to one, you're resistant to all in that class. So you knock out the entire class. So it's very, you know, much harder to respond to treatment once you've knocked out one or two classes of drugs, because you don't have many options left.
So do you, what percentage of patients of people with HIV are multi-drug resistant? Do you know if there's a number?
You know, I don't know that offhand. I'm sorry.
It's a small percentage, though.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah, it's so. I think I want to say 10 or 15%.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a small number, but you have to also keep in mind that a resistant virus can be transmitted. Multi-drug resistant virus can be transmitted. So if you've never been on treatment and you contract the virus and become HIV positive, you can become infected with a virus that is already resistant to one or more classes of drugs. So that's another reason to be, you know, even extra careful in, you know, protecting yourself.
So I think the number was 9 to 15% of patients in the United States with HIV. This is not, when they are told they have HIV, actually also have drug resistance as well.
Right.
I think that's the number that was, like, you know, from Croy.
Sure. I think that's right.
So there's that amount of people starting off with at least one resistant to one med, and usually it's NRTIs,
right?
With, like Systeva, which is kind of a problem because it is a once a day medication, a tripla. Systeva's in that. If you're resistant, you can't take it.
Right. It's one of those medications that's on the preferred list for the treatment guidelines. So that's a very powerful drug, and that's one that's very frequently used and recommended for first line treatment.
So it's a problem. So which word fits your situation? How do you see yourself as a rescue patient, a salvage patient, a multi drug resistant? I mean, which one, or just treatment experienced?
I probably fall somewhere in the treatment experience, probably intermediate level of treatment experience. So I've been on many different regimens. However, I have a lot of options available still to me. My immune system is relatively intact, so I wouldn't be really considered to be on salvage therapy for those reasons. If I were to develop resistance to the drugs that I'm currently on, then I might be giving you a different answer because of my current regimen. And I'm only on two different medications from two different classes of drugs, and if I were to develop resistance to those, then I could knock out two classes potentially very quickly. But right now I'm just treatment experience, and I'm probably in an intermediate level of treatment experience. So I've been on treatment since 1989, but I've been very lucky and very successful with my treatment.
So could you go through a little bit of your history?
Sure.
In 89, you were on AZT?
Right. So I started AZT monotherapy in 1989, and that was really the only drug that was around at the time. And saw a steady decline in my T cells over the next 5 years or so, and then I switched to D4T monotherapy.
By monotherapy, you mean just one drug?
Right, just one drug. So I switched off the AZT and onto D4T.
Well, just for fun?
Pardon?
Just for fun? I mean, was there a reason?
At that point, my T cells had dropped below 200, and so my doctor was concerned that the drug was not effective, AZT, so he switched me to Xeret, which was a newer drug at the time, and then not even a year later, I switched to, I added Epivir or 3TC to my D4T. And then about a year and a half after that, in September of 96, I switched to 3TC plus ATZ or Epivir plus Retrovir, which is Combivir, now known as Combivir, in one pill. But at that time it was two. So plus Verimune, which was the first time I was on an NNRTI, but only a few months after that, my viral load steadily increased, and that was the first time I had gotten a viral load was when I switched to adding the Verimune. It was 20,000, and then a couple months later, it was up to 40,000. So it took me off the Verimune, kept me on the 3TC and AZT, and added Crixivan. So, and then I did pretty well on that for a couple of years. Went to undetectable, and but then I developed a kidney stones.
Famous Crixivan side effect, right?
Yeah, famous Crixivan side effect. So even though it was working well for me, when I got the kidney stones, I had to unfortunately go off of it, and that's when I switched to Viracept. Never really did that well on Viracept plus Combivir, although, you know, I had a low viral load. I think it was, hovering, but it was always detectable. It was always above, the level of detection. So never could get to undetectable at that point after switching off to Crixivan. And then when my viral load started to steadily increase, and after I'd had a resistance test showing that I was indeed resistant to it, I switched to Kaletra and plus Systeva. Then my resistance in 2001, my resistance test showed that, which indeed I have begun to experience. So I'm also taking Lipitor to help control that. And I may have to switch off that just because of the, potential for metabolic complications and heart complications. but so far I've been lucky to have a very successful regimen. With the Kalitra
Institute. And so you went from a low T cell count of 177 to 800 now?
Yeah, right. So it's anywhere like 700, 800 T cells. So the immune system is, you know, very hardy in my case. And I've been very lucky. For someone who has technically fallen below that 200 level, and to come back up to where I am now, my percentages are pretty high too. My CD4 ratio and or CD8s, and it's interesting because I think everyone has you have to be everyone reacts responds differently to therapy and to treatment. So what works for one person isn't necessarily obviously going to work for another person. So you have to take each case by case.
Right, and I think a lot of people, when they hear that somebody has been through a lot of treatments, they think it's odd that they're taking a new treatment. Like, they think they'll have to come up with something really weird, kind of, and something that's in clinical trials. But you're on the only thing that's different is it's an unusual regimen, but the drugs that you're taking are very current. Like, they're the preferred drugs. And so, that's the thing that is not different.
Right.
Because I guess a lot of people think if you're treatment experienced, then you're going to be taking the, Miravirac or one of those kind of things. But there are a lot of people who haven't been exposed yet to Kalitra or Sustiva, who've been on treatment for years. They just never took those drugs, and they could be good drugs for them.
Oh, exactly. And that's the whole idea, too, is you want to try to spare those, as many drugs and classes that you can. So I know a lot of people who have been very successful and they're still on nukes and maybe one non-nuke, like Viramune, and they're in Truvada, and they've been on that for years, and they're doing very well with it. And they've never had to even go on protease inhibitors yet. So that's a great option. And, for many people to be able to do the class-sparing kind of regimens so they can save the protease inhibitor class or some of the newer classes that are coming out, like integrase inhibitors and entry inhibitors, for down the road when they'll need them. In case they'll need them.
So because you're sort of at risk of losing, you have two very important drugs that you're taking, and you don't want to become resistant to either of them. Are you very, worried about taking them on time and being really careful with that because of...
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I'm not worried simply because, and I'll say why, because I was on Crixivan, and at the time, it was unboosted when I took it. And meaning it wasn't boosted with Norovir, which is now recommended. I mean, the only time you would take Crixivan, if you would even take it, would be boosted with Norovir. But back when it first came out, you didn't. And you took it every 8 hours, and you took it on an empty stomach. And that was the most difficult thing, one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do. And I learned a lot from that experience in the sense that I was adherent for over 2 years, and I don't think I maybe missed one dose in that time, and so I never developed resistance, and it was very, very effective, but it was a very, very tough regimen, and it was always drilled into me from very early by all my doctors, luckily, how important it was to be adherent and to stay on and take your drugs on time and to take the right dosages, and that I would sometimes wake up in the middle of the night just to take my Crixivan on an empty stomach if I had to. And so that experience really taught me that adherence is just kind of become second nature for me. So I think it's something that you learn and that you can teach yourself, and you can use different things to remind you to be adherent, and so that I don't even really think about it anymore. And I always take my Kalitra 12 hours apart, one with breakfast, one with dinner, or one dose with breakfast, one dose with dinner, and then I take my Sativa when I go to bed. So it's just like second nature, like brushing my teeth.
Mm-hmm. So, for other people, for people listening to this, if they are multi-drug resistant or treatment experienced, and they know they have some resistance, what do you recommend that they do? I know you just put out this big issue about hope for survival, salvage therapy. So what are their options today?
Well, for people who are treatment experienced, I think the most important thing is to find a good provider. And
how would you define a good provider?
One who has a sizable percentage of patients with HIV, if you're lucky enough to have one like that in your area. If not, maybe drive to an area where they do.
But
there is that kind of a doctor.
Just from a sort of, how do you find that out? You call the doctor and say how many HIV positive patients you have, and you hope they'll answer honestly? They'll say they have a lot. So
yeah.
Come on over. I mean, you know, how do you, I mean, should you just call like a AIDS organization like Test Positive Aware Network in Chicago and say, I need a doctor nearby? Is that the best way? And then they'll recommend somebody who...
Yeah, that's a really good point. Many AIDS service organizations, Test Positive Aware Network here in Chicago, we produce an Illinois HIV services directory. So you can call us, we'll send you a directory, and you can look up, or you can go online and do the same thing. And they have directories in other cities as well, where you can find service providers in your area, and then you can call them and you can say, hey, look, you know, I'm HIV positive and I don't know any doctors and I just moved here to this area. Would you recommend anyone? And many times they'll give you recommendations over the phone, you know. So that's a great tool for people that they should use.
Because particularly I think for someone who has multi-drug resistance or someone who's treatment experienced, having an experience thing is critical. You know, I don't know if it's as critical for someone just beginning, but it's critical because of
right.
the resistance test and being able to read it, understand it, and because treating somebody with resistance is an art, I think, at this point. I mean,
absolutely.
People, you know, they know how to use mutations, you know, they know that, if you have, you know, so I think, you know, it's really critical that, you know, because we still get letters from people out there who, you know, say, my doctor says I'm resistant to everything and I should just, like, pack up my bags and, you know, prepare to die. And I'm like, what? Who's saying that?
Absolutely. I mean, we get letters, too, and it's kind of scary when some of the letters that we get and what the doctors are telling them to do. And it's like, no, first of all, get another doctor, you know, and but even with the guidelines, the treatment guidelines that are there for doctors, if they don't use them or
they don't know they exist.
Right. If they don't even know they exist, then you're really pretty much out there on your own. So definitely using resources in your area because many of these AIDS service organizations, including Test Positive Aware Network in Chicago, a lot of the people that work here and that I work with, you know, they're HIV positive themselves. So you can talk to a staff member or a client or a volunteer, somebody at the organization who's gone through some of these experiences themselves, and they can, you know, kind of hold your hand, kind of talk you through it and make, you know, give you some suggestions on what to do and where to go for treatment.
Right.
A really good point.
Right. So do you think most people are proactive about getting a resistance test and making sure it's understood by their doctors?
You know, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I would hope that they are. You know,
if the regimen's failing you.
If your regimen's failing you, thank you. Because remember, you don't fail your regimen, it fails you. If your treatment is failing and then you want to get a resistance test, you definitely always want to get a resistance test.
While you're still on the
regimen. Right. If your viral load becomes detectable, because it has to be detectable for you the resistance test to be even useful. And then decipher the different mutations. It's very complicated, so they really have to have some experience with that, and so that's why it's important to have an experienced provider. And then they can help you make a treatment decision based on your resistance profile. But I don't know if people are very proactive in that, and I would hope that people understand, the usefulness of resistance testing and where, and again, in the treatment guidelines, it will spell out very clearly when and where you should be using a resistance test and when they are recommended for people in the course of their treatment.
I know that the new recommendations are that if you have a detectable viral load for a length of time, I don't know how that's defined, but for a length of time that you should get a resistance test, and there can be changes made, meaning you should not stay with that detectable viral load. I believe that's the new recommendations. That there are so many new medications, and I guess out there, that there you can be switched, whether they're in clinical trial or under expanded access. But I know it's not just a marketing slogan. It's a physician recommendation at this point that there's no reason to stay with a detectable viral load for most people.
For most people, correct.
Yeah. I mean, there's some who are still resistant to everything, but there are these new classes, integrase inhibitors, and if they, could get people on that or get people on the CCR5 inhibitor, or then those are two new classes that nobody can be resistant to, really.
Correct. And even though these drugs aren't approved yet, they are currently in expanded access, so they all have expanded access programs. Merck's integrase, Raltegravir, Revere, MK-0518, and Pfizer's entry inhibitor, Maraviroc, have expanded access programs, so they should be able to get access to these drugs if they need them. They shouldn't have to not have any options, and they shouldn't be resistant to those drugs.
So it is a different world.
It is. It's a whole. The entire landscape is changing. It's an exciting time, and I think this year is going to be an exciting year for HIV therapy, and already is. And there's other drugs in addition to the two that I mentioned that are being developed and in clinical trials. And there's a new non-nuke, Atravirine by Tibotec, and that's also and expanded access. So, and Prezista, the new protease that was released last year, I believe, is really good for people with resistant mutations. So, are already resistant to many of the current protease inhibitors. So, it was in fact developed for those patients specifically in mind.
So, hopefully, this information has gotten out there to people, because I know a lot of people were complacent, like, oh, well, I'm waiting for the next drug to come along. So, we decided not to change my medications, even though my viral load is, 50,000 or whatever.
Right.
But this is, hopefully the news got to everybody that should not be the case anymore, that there are new meds and they could get to undetectable, possibly. Because, I don't know, you know a lot of people who are positive, and as I do, and a lot of people are telling me they're undetectable for the first time in 25 years.
Exactly. And it's exciting, and they're doing clinically very well, and they're feeling better, and they're looking better, and they, it's a term that was used 10 years ago when the protease inhibitors first, came out, was Lazarus syndrome, and people literally rising from the dead. And this is another time that's, hopefully going to offer a lot of new hopes and a lot of new options for people that haven't had them. And so it's, it's exciting. We're really lucky to have these new drugs and the development and the research that's going into, new different classes of drugs, because it definitely opens up the doors. And, as you said, there's a lot of people now that are for the first time undetectable in the whole course of their treatment history. And this is the first time it's ever really happened for them.
script. I guess we need a new term for this era. Like we had the Lazarus syndrome or whatever. We had a wonderful term, and we had a way to name the new era. We need a new name. That's not a marketing slogan. I guess we'll have to think of something. So anyway, so thank you so much, Jeff. Good luck with your regimen, and I hope you don't have to go off of it. And we'll give everyone your email so that they can contact you for questions.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much. And read your issue. Congratulations on getting your issue out on time.
Great. Thank you so much, Bonnie. Yeah, if people want to, they can contact us for copies of the March-April issue. And
so they can just get it in via mail as well, if they want it mailed to them?
Yes, we can mail it out to them, or we can let them know where they can get it in their area if they would rather pick it up at an aid service organization in their area. It's also available online at our website, www.tpan.com. And also in the May-June issue that will be coming out next month, we'll be talking about some of the new drugs that were reported on at the Retrovirus Conference in L.A. In February. So there's a lot of new drugs that we didn't even talk about that are coming down the line that are give a lot of reason for hope for a lot of people. So it's an exciting time.
Great.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
You've reached the end of This Month in HIV's program. To read the transcript or let us know what you think of this program, please visit www.thebody.com/HIV month.